Hello, and welcome to the Mericast, the show that puts you on the fast track to business confidence. The people I interview here have either given me my business confidence directly or inspired me in other ways. Jim James is a truly remarkable man. He's been off in Singapore and China doing incredible entrepreneurial things for many years, and you'll hear about these in just a minute. Now he's back in the UK, taking on new challenges through his podcast, books and training courses. For me, though, it's what he has learned along the way that resonates most. In this podcast, Jim talks about how he climbed his entrepreneurial Everest, whether you need to be brave to run a business, and the critical importance of cash flow to success. But let's start with Jim's adventures as a young man.
I have been an entrepreneur since the age of 27, formally when I went to Singapore to start up my first company. So I have been, if like making my own way, paying my own way since 1995. First of all, in Singapore, starting the East West Public Relations Company, and then a couple of other entrepreneurial ventures there. And then I moved to China in 2004, started the agency there, started a few other things, including for your community, I started importing Morgan sports cars to China.
Wow.
And
right.
A couple of other things, including the British Business Awards in China, which are just coming up again this year. And then I moved back to England in 2019, Trevor, to bring my daughters back to school. And now I've started a podcast come book publishing called The Unnoticed Entrepreneur, which is all around ways that entrepreneurs can get noticed without needing an agency. That's me. That's 25 years in, like 2.5 minutes.
Okay. Well, I don't know when to end the interview there, because I think there's a lot to sort of unwrap in all this. I mean, so why did you go to China in the first place? Well, how did you end up there?
Well, I went to China because in 2001, China entered the World Trade Organization. And I've been in Singapore, you know, Southeast Asia since 95. And there was this gravitational pull towards China after 2001 when it opened up. Before that, it was all to Hong Kong. And really, it was just this amazing sense that there's an opportunity and an adventure, really, Trevor. I was lucky enough as a younger person to live in America and go to university there and live in Africa. And China, you know, was new, but also with 1.4 billion people growing onto the world stage, as an entrepreneur, it felt like Mount Everest, really, right? It was there, and I couldn't resist the urge to have a crack at it.
So there you were at the foot of Everest. The work to do with the franchise around the automobiles and so on, I mean, did that just come naturally? How did you get that?
So like every, you know, entrepreneurial venture, there's some opportunity, and then there's measuring up some risk, and then looking at the reward and looking at the environment. So in China, it was going to become the world's largest auto market. And today it's larger than Europe and America combined. So I was like, okay, there's this huge opportunity. And the domestic auto market in China was very, very low down the sort of quality scale. And also no classic car market in China, because they have had no history of automotive manufacture, and they don't allow the import of secondhand cars. Okay, so no classic cars. And Morgan fits really nicely into that category, because it's a car brand that you can drive on the road today, but actually the design's from 1936. So what I did was, first of all, think, well, okay, this is an opportunity. And then I bought a car under my public relations company. Amazingly enough, I was able to import a Morgan four-seater Roadster as a company car, Trevor. Yeah, I know, exactly, right? So there was a little loophole. We imported this this Morgan, and then I showed it to a few people, and I put it in front of the British ambassador's residence in Beijing, because I happened to be on the Chamber of Commerce committee and I knew people there. So and I put it out there and started to ask people if they would be interested to buy one. And, you know, just a sort of a market tester. This was the first Morgan car imported to China.
Wow.
Right. So people are like, wow, what is it? Such a Lao Ye Chush Shamiz, right? They're like, what is it? It's an old car, classic car. What is it? And sure enough, I sold one on the ambassadors. I don't tell them that, because they'll probably charge me a commission. But anyway, they were very, very helpful. The embassy, fantastic. Sebastian Wood. So Sebastian Wood was the ambassador at the time. And that was then the sort of the proof of concept. And then I take the car driving and found a journalist taking pictures of my car. And I said, well, look, you've got a nice camera and I have a PR firm. Let's do a shoot. Do you want to do a shoot at the world's first Morgan car in China? And he said, yeah, OK. And so we drove the car into the Forbidden City. Wow. And so I've got this great picture of us driving into the Forbidden City. And that piece of PR, Trevor, and you'll appreciate this because of your journalism background, really started the publicity for the company. So I got one proof of concept sale, and then I got a publicity shoot, pure stunt for free. Before the police arrived, we got a whole bunch of shots. And over the next 8 years, we imported 65 cars. I built the brand to a multi-million pound business, appointed distributor or sub-dealers in Shanghai and Guangzhou and Chengdu. And we were not a franchise. It was my own business. So basically, I was the only foreigner who was a car importer. And so I'd buy the cars FOC from Malvern, and I would import them and sell them into China. And as a result of that work, I was recruited by Lotus to become the interim CEO for Lotus Cars for 6 months in China. So we had a lot of fun, Trevor, really. And then with that, I started the British Motorsport Festival because we needed a platform for these British niche brands. And so I ran that for a couple of years. And then some people approached us to start the import of a company called Wake Drinks from the UK. And so we started to import this amazing British energy drink to China. So China was the Everest because it was like so big and there's so many paths to the top, you know, obviously the odd avalanche on the way up there. But overall, that, as in a nutshell, that was the journey. It was fantastic.
So, I mean, that's hugely impressive, quite inspiring, I think. But did you, I mean, you make it sound as if just one thing led to another and I talked to this guy and then this thing happened and so on. I mean, were you sort of at any time thinking, oh, I'm taking on a bit of a risk here? Have I got the money to do this? What was your sort of view of sort of risk versus reward at that time? Did you just have a natural bent towards, well, why not try and see what happens?
Yeah, I think that's central to certainly the more mature entrepreneur. You know, when I was 27 and went to Singapore, it was quite a big risk. And I put more of, if you like, my life assets into that business. Although I did leave half of my assets in the UK when I went to Singapore. So I think this idea of burning your bridges is not a sensible idea. It actually creates too much risk and too much pressure. In China with Morgan, yes, it was a big capital adventure, Trevor, to the extent that what we had to do, for example, was to get enough capital to build the showroom, to manage to circumvent the capital import restrictions of $50,000, I had to sell my car. So that was a little bit disappointing because, of course, I loved that Roadster, but I had to sell it in order to fund the showroom. But what we also managed to do, Trevor, was to do the pricing and the deposit and payment model such that the company, in effect, became self-funded. So we did a trade show. I reached out to the UK consulate in Chengdu and asked them if they knew any good car distributors that were interested in the brand. So what I did was I funded it by finding dealers and get them to prepay for cars. And the prepayment then meant that I didn't have to have any borrowing. So yes, it was a little bit of a tightrope because we had currency fluctuations, capital controls. Over 12 months, we had to register with 13 different ministries. And I did a podcast, I did a blog post on this. And I actually have all these on my blog. I did one every week setting up the company. So there were a lot of variables, Trevor, I think is the truth. You know, my wife, Erica, is a Shanghainese and she was brilliant. And we also found some really good local partners. But I suppose, you know, one of the joys of being a slightly younger entrepreneur, I was 40 at the time, was the sense that you could take more of a risk. You know, as a young entrepreneur, you can take risks. You've not got enough time to make it back. As you get older, you need to manage the risk more carefully, you know. But I think that the joy of being an entrepreneur isn't that you take reckless decisions, right? That's not what this is about. Someone said to me, you're so brave to be an entrepreneur. And it's not about bravery because it's no more brave than taking a job that you hate and going on the train every day, right? It's about understanding where the risks lie and then try to mitigate those risks. Setting up a company in China increases your risks. I didn't speak the language. Taking on a category I'd never been involved with, I'd done tech PR for 15 years, to get into cars was a risk as well. So there are a number of risks, but there were solutions to each risk. And those solutions often lay in finding the right people. In fact, they always lie in finding the right people, to be honest, Trevor. So as an entrepreneur, what you don't know only hurts you if you don't recognize what you don't know, because that's where hubris sets in. So I've made enough mistakes to know when I'm going to make another one. I'm not perfect, but I know I'm going to be making mistakes. So now what I do is I look for who would help me to if you like, forestall those mistakes. So in China, we made some mistakes, but we built this amazing business and it was great fun. And overall, I do think you only accomplish in proportion to what you attempt, you know. And my challenge to myself was to build something that I'd never done before, somewhere that I'd never done it. And, you know, come back to the Everest thing, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, you do it because you want to solve a problem, but also you want to challenge yourself.
That is so true. I mean, going back to the point you made about it's not being about bravery. I mean, certainly from my perspective, when I set up my business, people said exactly the same thing to me. They said, oh, that's brave. Or I would have friends at dinner parties here where I live in St. Albans just saying, you're going to do what? You're going to sort of set up your own business. And they would look very doubtfully at me and feel sorry for me. I said, well, why don't you just go and get another job? I talked to my wife about it. I mean, she gave me typical qualified supportive advice, like, well, go and do it if it makes you happy, but you've got 6 months and don't F it up. And that's how it started. And I found that not only in 6 months I hadn't, but also I didn't feel brave. I just felt that this felt natural. This actually felt quite secure to me because I felt like I was a master of whether I succeeded or not, that if I did F it up, then it would be my own effing fault.
Yeah, I think the other thing is about cash. You know, most businesses fail because it's a shit idea, right? And then those that have an okay idea, they run out of cash before they've realized it, you know, sufficiently. And so for anyone, you know, for your listeners here, when I went to China, I went with an existing business that I was running. I had a PR firm. And so I was able to capitalize the Morgan business without running out of money before I could get to the other side. You know, I had 12 months. I spent over £100,000 just renovating a showroom, for example. So if you're going to start a business, one of the most important documents you can do isn't your website, it's your cash flow statement. And I think so few people, when they're entrepreneurs, think about the financial side. And I'm a PR marketing person. I'm not an accountant, but I do know it doesn't matter how good your PR is. If you run out of cash, you're begging for work or you go back to a job. So if there's, many things that I've learned, but one of the things, Trevor, for your audience about entrepreneurship is remove the risk by removing the anxiety of financial shortfall, because actually the tension comes from running out of money before you've got enough coming in. And that's why, you know, multinationals are so relaxed because they've got cash flow.
That is brilliant. Brilliant advice for our listeners. Just quickly on what you did in Singapore, because we've talked a fair bit about China. When you went to Singapore, what were you doing there? Can you tell listeners?
Yes, I went with two suitcases to start East West Public Relations, which is the agency I still have in Singapore, many, many moons later. And that was because in the 1990s, when I graduated, we had 3 million people unemployed. We had 14 to 16% interest rates, if you remember. You're too young for this.
I'm not.
My generation, you know. And so I went because Asia was going through digitalization. You know, there was a mega trend towards, in my case, television and music studios moving towards the adoption of digital instead of analog. So if there's another sort of key point, Trevor, you know, I mentioned earlier about in China, the mega trend was car ownership, right? Because in China, people were owning like one car between 1,000, whereas in the US, it's, you know, one car between like 100 or even 10 people, right? So in 1995, the mega trend in Southeast Asia was towards digitalization. So for an entrepreneur, if you can identify a mega trend, there's a great guy called Daniel Burris who talks about, you know, global trends. He highlights what these cool trends are going to be. I didn't, by the way, learn about him until I got to Singapore, which is a shame, but I'm borrowing his concept. But my life was kind of living along that narrative. So as an entrepreneur, if you can find a mega trend, which in the 90s was that Southeast Asia was becoming, you know, Asian tigers and growing. And that's why I went. So I set up the PR firm and you know, within a couple of years, we had the largest independent agency in Southeast Asia, 14 people, and it was great fun. So that's what I did then to start the agency. So, you know, another location, another opportunity, a different kind of business.
Brilliant. When you came back, was that when you wrote the book, The Unnoticed Entrepreneur, or did you write it whilst you were still out there?
Yeah, so I'm going to say my wife says that I didn't write the book, and I'm a cheat. So no, just to be clear, Trevor, what I did, I started the podcast to help entrepreneurs to have the information that we charge clients for. So how to get noticed for free. And then I was interviewing people and I thought it's there in 20 minute batches, and I make it into an ask and I put it to Medium, onto LinkedIn, on Twitter, Facebook. And I thought, why don't I curate that into a book? And so the reason my wife says that I'm not an author is because although I've created this sort of methodology and curated it, I've got 50 experts. So they're a masterclass, really, 50 interviews made into one book. And volume two is coming out in July, because now I'm at 450 episodes of the show and I've got over 135 guests. So where we get 50 every 6 months, we're rolling out another volume. And I've got some people in India publishing the book in India as well now. And so the idea is that, you know, your listeners that might be saying, well, you know what, they can go online and look for blog for blog for blog. And there's a lot of clickbait out there, isn't there? So you can find yourself reading and just finding yourself entering a password and email and getting a, you know, an ebook. So The Unnoticed Entrepreneur is really a companion to the podcast.
Right.
With the views that someone might want to hold that and dip in and learn about, whether it's customer experience or AI for content creation, whether it is about strategy, case studies and so on are all in there.
You see, in my eyes, you're as much of an author as anyone else.
You can speak to my wife.
Because what you need to do is, yes, okay, somebody's come in as an expert and given this bit of advice or this bit of strategy in there, but the actual process of curation and turning it into a coherent whole and giving it a title, The Unnoticed Entrepreneur, is actually an art in itself in terms of what you're doing with things. And you need to sort of have a sort of strand running through it, or else it comes across as 50 sort of random humble jumble bits of advice. So you need a sort of overarching thing and the way to bring it into some sort of narrative. So the fact that you've done that makes you just as much of an author as anybody else. You can produce a book from a great vision and then explain the vision, or you can produce a book from the ground up. So as somebody who's written books and helped people write papers, I can tell you, you're in the author camp as far as I'm concerned. So,
Trevor, thank you. And coming from you, I know you've written 5 books, I think it is, isn't it?
Three.
Okay, well, I'm sure you've got two more coming. But thank you. And I think that also what it's worth perhaps sharing is that the model I've taken, which got the book into the, you know, the British Book Awards, you know, finalist list, where, you know, you and I were the other day in London, is, as one of the judges said to me, you know, a book doesn't have to be War and Peace or, you know, the big tome. It needs to deliver value to the reader. And that can take many different forms. And often, a bit like entrepreneurship, it gets built into something mythical and unattainable. But actually, entrepreneurship, like authorship, is whatever you want to make it. There isn't really a right or wrong. What matters is that you add value to the person you're making it for. You know, so if I'm writing a book, and I've sold now quite a few, amazingly enough, and people write to me, but they also write to each other, because I include a directory of all the people inside the book. And I've had people say, I got a job because someone read about me in your book and you're kindly putting the contact details in, and they've connected. So for me, that's adding value as a curator, in the same way that as an entrepreneur with my PR business, I need to add value to my clients. So, and we can all do that in our own unique way, right? There isn't a one size fits all. And that's kind of the beauty of being an entrepreneur, really. You can make your own path.
Was there a particular piece of advice that came out of the book from one of these experts that you thought, God, I wish I'd known that 20 years ago?
You know, it's a good question. I think that what's changed from then is the impact of technology. So a lot of the recurring themes, partly because I'm interested in MarTech, is that technology really is your friend now. And I was quite a fan of tech back in the 90s, but now it really is so enabling. I think that if there's something that I learned that I had never really addressed before, was customer experience. And I think for all of us now, because social media means that your customer can become your critic simultaneously, it's no longer the case that you can isolate a happy or unhappy customer from potential customers. And so I think that's probably one of the key themes that's coming out, not only the AI in CX as customer experience, but there's a whole industry around taking care of people online during the customer journey. And that's something I hadn't really appreciated all those years ago. I thought I did something well and I sold it. And now really seeing the whole customer journey is much more sophisticated and much more enabled by technology now, Trevor, than I was ever really aware of.
So, Jim, we know about the fact that you've got the volume 2 of The Unnoticed Entrepreneur coming in July. But could you just tell us a little bit more about what you're up to now? Is there anything you're particularly excited about in terms of where you see your business going?
Yeah, Trevor, thank you for asking. So the whole concept behind The Unnoticed Entrepreneur is to help entrepreneurs to get noticed, right, and get connected to each other, because that's often when the magic happens. So one is I have a range of merchandise. So I have the Entrepreneur Merch Company on Etsy with half a dozen items at the beginning, cups, mugs, phone cases, those sort of things that people could wear. And if they're like on a train or something, you find someone else wearing it, go, hey, you're also an entrepreneur. Then I have Kajabi as a platform. I'm going to be putting my sort of training courses on there. So some of the wisdom that I've got around that's come from the book, but also my own sort of 30 years of running businesses and helping clients get noticed, I shall put that in as courses. And so then we've got this sort of matrix of things. I don't think I'm going to try and build a community, Trevor, because, there are lots of great communities already, and I'm not suggesting I'm a tribe leader necessarily. I just have some knowledge that may be of use. And so if there are entrepreneurs as well that think that some of the knowledge I've got is useful, then I'll also have a consulting practice. So it's the podcast, it's the books, it's the courses, it's the merchandise. And then, any time that people think that I can help them personally, then I'll do that too.
There's always another Everest, isn't there? There's always more to do, things sort of further on. And as you find when you try and climb Everest, not that I have, but you find you get to the top of one bit and you find there's more to do, there's more to achieve. So it never ends. And I guess that's what part of the joy is.
Well, exactly. I think that the journey is part of it, as you say, and accomplishing Everest, for example, is great. But then you go, okay, well, what next? And I think one of the joys of being an entrepreneur is that you can continue to challenge yourself. When I work for other people, which I managed for three years, I wasn't massively successful at work. I mean, I got promoted and everything. I did a good job, but I found it intensely frustrating was that someone else would always determine what I was going to do next. And now I'm back in the UK. I've divided Southeast Asia, North Asia, now back in the UK. My next challenge is to build a business in a very mature market, in a very sort of regulation heavy, tax heavy environment. Whereas in China, you can see within years, I was hosting festivals, importing drinks, importing cars, running a PR firm. I invested in a tech company. Like there was no shortage every day of things to do. But here it's like everybody already owns a niche. And so the challenge, Trevor, is now actually not an Everest, but like the sea, where everything looks like you can't see any contours. And you've got to try and pick out the currents and see where would be the right place to try and sail my entrepreneurial boat to.
I love your metaphors. They're fantastic. All right. I might nick a few of those.
Drinking too much tea this afternoon.
So I just wanted to say, what is the best way for people to get in touch with you or find out more about you or your organization?
Well, I use Linktree. Are you familiar with Linktree?
I am, yes.
Which is a great platform. So I'm just Jim A. James on Linktree. And then I also have the unnoticed.cc is the podcast. And I'm also on LinkedIn, just Jim James and East West Public Relations.
Well, what a great interview. What stuck with me was Jim's view that being an entrepreneur is not an act of bravery at all when you consider the alternatives. And then there's the ongoing importance of cash flow in running a business and how Jim looked for what he called megatrends to work with in order to give him the best chance of success. Well, thank you for tuning in. And if you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate and review the show through your usual podcast provider. If you want to find out more about the Merricast or our business Merriborne Media, you can find us on LinkedIn or email me at trevor.merriborne@merriborne.co.uk. Don't forget to join us for our next episode. And until then, thanks for listening.